Hello, and welcome to the Badger Talks podcast, the podcast that shares interviews with experts from the University of Wisconsin-Madison community about their work, research, and a little bit about what they're like as people, too. I'm your host, Buzz Kemper. Today, we'll be talking about More Than Words, How Talking Sharpens the Mind and Shapes Our World. And I'm happy to have as my guest, Professor Emerit Mary Ellen McDonald. Mary Ellen McDonald, thanks so much for being on Badger Talks. This is going to be a really fun topic.
Oh, thanks so much, Buzz. I'm really happy to be here.
So you are a psycholinguist, and that is a term with which I was unfamiliar until I read your bio. So let's start with that. What is psycholinguistics?
So many people joke that it's linguists who are psychotic, and that is not us.
All right, okay.
It is somebody kind of in between cognitive psychology and linguistics. I study how we do what I'm doing right now, which is turning my internal ideas into talking, and what you do, which is right now, which is listening to me, and you're turning sound waves into an understanding of what I'm saying.
And what does one learn from that? First, I mean, there's two sides to this. One is, what do you learn by studying it? And what does the person speaking learn, or what is the benefit to them from actually turning these thoughts into words?
Right. So the field, we'll start with the field
more
generally.
Let's start with the field, yeah.
Has all sorts of applications, like by understanding these processes of comprehension and language production, we can help people who have brain injury and aphasia. It helps us understand how children learn language. It helps us understand how second language learning works, and lots of stuff like that. Okay. Now, personally, the fact that I'm talking is actually doing me cognitive good, and that's the topic of my book, that there is the hidden benefits of talking that people don't know about, and I wanted to bring those to light.
Okay, terrific. And what are they? That leads to the obvious next question, because I have read many books and heard interviews with people who speak about the fact that, I think this is actually kind of a Buddhist thing too, that we don't learn anything from speaking because we're just saying things that we already know of. Where we learn is from listening to others. And you are about to prove that to be incorrect.
I am.
All right, let's go.
So first thing I should do is be a good plugger of my book and say its title. So the book is called More Than Words, How Talking Sharpens the Mind and Shapes Our World. It's available from Penguin Random House Avery.
Yes, and thank you for bringing me a copy. I look forward to reading it.
Good, good, yes. Now, what does talking do? Let's start with what it does and then maybe why it has these effects.
Great.
So what it does, talking sharpens our attention, makes us more likely that we will follow through on plans that we've talked about. It reduces the incidence of dementia in old age. It increases children's readiness for school. Little kids who talk more themselves, not necessarily get talked to, but talk themselves, are more ready for school. And it helps regulate our emotions. So naming the emotions that we're feeling help us understand what we're feeling rather than just some amorphous, I'm upset, that's not, could be lots of things, angry, disappointed, and so on. Naming exactly what we're feeling helps us understand what we're feeling and also helps us calm down when the upset feeling is really overwhelming and lets us think more logically and more.
Yeah. Yeah, that makes sense, because how many times have we heard a friend or a loved one say, something's bothering me and I need to talk about it. Yeah, so there is that obvious thing. But then apparently, then from what you're saying, the process, and I'd love to get into more of this too, the process of turning a thought into words and then
our mouth being able to form those words and put them out there and be understood. How much of that part of the mechanics is part of your work, or is that a separate thing?
That is really crucial, first, to my work in general. I study how that works.
Yeah.
And also it's crucial to all of these benefits that talking has. So I borrow a term from education called desirable difficulty. So in education, something that's a desirable difficulty is like a challenging lesson or math problem that's doable, but really kind of challenges the student and pushes them to use all of their facilities to get it done. And those are a desirable difficulty because it's sort of obvious. If everybody just always studies 2 + 2 = 4, they never advance. They have to have something that's at the edge of their abilities. Talking, I say, is a desirable difficulty. It's much harder than understanding, and it works the brain in certain ways that basically spill over to have all of these other hidden benefits, like tuning our attention and regulating our emotions and all of that.
Okay. What makes it harder to speak than to understand? So in other words, you're telling me that when I'm listening to you, my brain is having to work a little less hard than when I am responding to you.
That's right.
Great.
And all sorts of studies show, you know, brain imaging studies show the brain is working less hard, and all kinds of other ways to measure how hard our brains are working show that the talking side is harder. And this is because what we're doing when we're talking is a conversion process. We have some goal to communicate, or idea, doesn't have any language associated with it yet, and we have to turn that into something over many stages, picking the words, getting them in order, getting their pronunciation, and finally getting the muscle movements in order to let us talk. And that's a lot of conversion that you do, more than just when listening, although listening isn't the easiest thing we do in the world either.
Right.
But that process of converting one thing, a goal, into another thing, muscle movements, with all of this other stuff in between, is really hard work. Hmm. So, for example, if I needed to say to you, oh, I can't go to lunch because I really have to finish this report. So that's a simple sentence. And but to say that, just, or even part of it, I really need to finish this report, I need to get those 7 words out of my brain to use in the sentence.
Right.
And we have 50,000 or more words stored in our brain, and we have to get those 7 and only those 7, can't muck it up with other words we don't need to say.
Right,
and
you can't just throw otter
Exactly, yes. And so we have to have a method of digging out just what we need. And the way we do that is to focus really intently, even if you're not consciously aware of it, on the ideas that we need to convey in order to get words that suit those ideas. And that focus is part of the benefit of talking, having focused intently on the idea that I need to finish this report. I am more likely now to do the work of the report and actually get it done. So that's one example of how the focus and the difficulty of talking ends up benefiting us.
And by saying that, you're also, you're making this commitment in addition to doing all that, what was the word you used? Conversion?
Yes.
Yeah. In addition to doing all that conversion, you're also making a commitment now to both yourself and the person to whom you're speaking that I'm going to finish this report. Is that part of it too? Does that reinforce the goal?
That probably does.
Okay.
You don't even have to have another person there, though. You can just say it to yourself. And it's many studies, particularly in the sporting world, athletes are trained a lot to talk to themselves. It's called self-talk.
Yeah.
And there doesn't have to be anybody there. They may be running a marathon or whatever, and they are saying in their head, or maybe out loud, I got to keep going. Or the tennis player thinks, I got to use my backhand more. Or whatever it is that they need to do, they're talking to themselves and getting benefit from it. Huge literature in the athletics field about this kind of self-talk. And it actually contradicts something you mentioned at the beginning of the interview, this Buddhist idea that you only learn by listening.
Right.
Why would you talk to yourself when all you already know what you are saying?
Yeah.
In fact, the mental processes of producing what you might already know and making it associated with language and a message that you can perceive yourself is beneficial.
Right. Right. Okay. Yeah, that makes total sense. And at first I thought that that whole idea of one only learns through listening made sense, because if I articulate to you my opinion on, let's say, a foreign relations situation, I'm only speaking to you what I've already been mulling over in my head. But then when you tell me your perspective, now I'm going to learn something new, because you are going to be aware of something that perhaps I'm not, or you're going to look at it in a different way. But it's great to know that we also learn and we also get advantage from actually speaking and putting our thoughts into words. And yeah, because it does require that one organizes the thought, because I have to make it sound not like a jumbled mess to you.
Right.
That, right.
Right. Or
right.
Even to yourself, if you're just talking to yourself.
Correct.
So.
Right, right. What is it about humans that give us this ability? I know that I've been around animals long enough to know that they communicate, but they don't, there doesn't seem to be the specificity. There don't seem to be words and languages, at least not that I'm aware of. So it seems that humans have a unique ability. So first of all, is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. And do we know why that is? What is it about our brains that, first of all, saw the need for that, and second of all, then made it happen, made it work?
So animals definitely communicate with each other,
yes.
And they often have innate, inborn abilities to do calls or postures or other kinds of behaviors,
yeah,
that
yeah.
that gestures that communicate with each other. Animals can also learn to understand each other, at least smart animals can.
Mm-hmm.
So the chickadees in our backyards, right around here in Wisconsin, have this inborn call that makes it clear when there's a predator coming. And other animals, like the squirrels or other birds, pay attention to that chickadee's call and will scramble away if they hear the predator call.
Oh, wow. So someone has a squirrel thinking, that's okay, I speak chickadee.
Yeah.
I can.
Yeah.
I know what he's saying. Oh, that's
and
awesome.
And so they have remarkable abilities to learn from other species. And we can harness those abilities to have our pets or other animals learn some of our language. And lots of people will tell you that their dog or their cat understands things. And that's not wrong. They do understand a good chunk of language. And I talk in the book about a border collie, very smart animals, who understood in very careful studies over 1,000 words. And that's true. There's a lot of understanding there. But what border collies and dogs and chimpanzees who have been taught language, who can understand, they don't talk themselves. They don't produce language themselves. Some chimpanzees have been trained to produce gestures. Careful analyses of those gestures show they're basically like tricks. They're not conversing. They make the sign for banana to get a banana, make the sign for orange to get an orange, and
right.
that sort of thing.
Right.
So,
they know the cause and effect.
Yes,
and,
absolutely. They're smart.
But they're not saying the word in their head.
Yes, and they're not trying to communicate about an orange. They are trying to get an orange. And so people have been puzzling about why this is, that animals can understand but not produce language.
Right.
And the stories, there are a couple of different stories right now. One of them that I think is promising is the idea that these animals, for reasons that we don't understand, don't feel any pressure to inform other individuals about anything except via their innate calls. So
right.
a chimpanzee has all sorts of innate calls that inform other members of the troop that they're here, they're dominant, they're subordinate, there's predators, all that stuff.
Right.
They've got them, all the inborn ones, and they inform in that way just by using the calls they are born with.
Okay.
And they don't seem to be able to extend it to have new information. So that's a partial explanation. Why is that? What brain networks are they missing? What pressures of evolution are different and so forth? I think we don't fully understand that.
Okay.
But we inform people of things, not just via some innate stuff we have, but
right.
also via language and talking.
Yeah, that way we can get into subtleties, not just I want a banana or there's a predator there, but here is my opinion on why the price of tea is high. Right. Yeah,
that's right.
That is absolutely amazing. And what are the specific benefits? Because in reading about some of your work, it says that talking shapes everything from our attention, memory, the way we learn to regulate our emotions, and our cognitive health as we age. So, yeah, I just want to unpack that a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
How do you know that, and how does that work?
Right,
yeah.
Right. So that sentence comes from maybe five different fields in psychology, and they hadn't been paying attention to each other. You know, the athletes do the athlete learning benefit of talking for athletics, and therapists talk about the benefit of talking in certain cases, and then there's the gerontologists who study old age and so forth. And what I did in the book was use my own knowledge of talking and to understand why all of these things were beneficial and try to pull together all of these different fields in one place to tell this story.
Okay.
Now, you asked me, how do we know that?
Yeah,
and
how do we know
and we know it somewhat differently in each of these different fields, because these people have been doing their research pretty isolated from something else. So the basic idea of, maybe we could divide it into the benefits of talking in the moment.
Mm-hmm.
So the moment you're talking, you get this benefit, and then the benefits of talking that kind of accrue over a lifetime.
Okay.
So for the in-the-moment kinds of studies, researchers could divide research subjects into two groups, and they give them a task to do. And in one case, perhaps they tell them to talk to themselves, or they create a situation in which it would be natural for them to talk to themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And the other group is maybe explicitly told not to talk, or it's just the situation doesn't really seem to need any talking.
Okay.
And in those kinds of studies, we find that people who talk to themselves are more vigilant, they pay better attention, they have more perseverance, they are more strategic in the cases of sort of sports strategy and so on. So the people who are doing the talking end up behaving differently and achieving more than the people in the no talking group.
Yeah, and that busts another myth, because we think of talking to ourselves as being kind of a little wacky.
That's right.
Yeah.
It's associated with, you know, kind of being a little out of it or old or whatever, but it's actually strategic. You can use it strategically, and you know, million-dollar athletes, multi-millionaire athletes do this all the time, and you too can.
Yeah.
All of our listeners could apply those same kinds of strategies.
So basically, what we're talking about in those instances is giving yourself a pep talk.
It can be.
It can be.
It can be, and It can be a you can do it sort of thing. It okay. could also be a rehearsing of strategy that you need to do for whatever difficult thing you need. It could be as simple as, oh, you're looking for your keys on your messy desk, and you say, keys, 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 while you're looking. Mm-hmm. And saying keys helps you develop an internal image of your own keys, which helps you look for something that looks like your own keys on the desk. And so it can be a pep talk, but there's lots more than just pep talk okay. going on there.
Wow. What's the most, and maybe you've already hit on it because there's so many fascinating aspects to this research, but can you identify what you would call the most surprising thing that you have learned from this research and writing the book?
I think there are a lot of them. Why don't I say one that I haven't talked about yet?
Yes, please.
Which is about babies learning language and little kids learning language. Mm. And people are told all the time from their pediatricians, from public service announcements on TV, all sorts of stuff, that it is important to talk to your kid.
Yes.
And that's not wrong. You should talk to your kid. But it turns out that even more important than the sheer amount of words that are incoming to the kid is how much the kid talks herself. And so really, that really sets a whole field on its ear that constantly has been harping about talk to your kid, talk to your kid. Mm-hmm. And it has all these practical implications. So if you're a parent and you have heard this message of your kid needs lots of language being directed at it, mm-hmm. you could talk to your kid. You could also hand them an iPad in which something is talking on the screen. Or turn on the TV to a Dora the Explorer cartoon or something.
Right.
So, and any of those have language being directed to it, mm-hmm. the baby or the child. But now if we realize, oh, the kid has to be talking himself mm-hmm. or herself.
Right.
And what happens when the kid gets an iPad or the TV is on? There's no talking.
Right. It's all one direction.
Yes.
Yeah.
And the parents aren't talking to the kid, and the kid is not talking. And so lots of use of media to children is associated with poor readiness in school several years later on. And lots of use of the kid's own talking, lots mm-hmm. of talking by the kid is associated with really good school readiness. Mm-hmm. And so really, this whole hidden story about the child's own talking has these enormous implications for parenting.
Okay. You know? That is fascinating because it is not a surprise to me at all that a child who spends a lot of time in front of a screen is going to generally have less readiness for school situations, for you know, for a number of situations, any social situation. But I didn't realize why. Part of the why is because the child is not themselves forming thoughts that they then put into words that they then communicate to others. And their brain is not doing that, which you have already defined as hard work.
Mm-hmm. Wow. That's right. That's right. And of course, they're social. Kids should have social interaction experiences
right.
and all of that too.
Yeah.
But the talking is a really crucial part of all of that brain development.
Wow. So with everybody staring at screens nowadays, are we losing ground in your, is that something that you have discovered or noticed? Is that a thing?
I am very worried about it.
Yeah.
Not just in little kids, but in young adults, for example.
Right. Yeah.
The studies show that they have far fewer face-to-face conversations than mm-hmm. in previous generations. And they text, but studies of texting suggest it's not as enriched or as interactive or socially rewarding as actual conversation. And so if we are having fewer conversations And there's a loneliness epidemic, which has been charted in public health for a number of years now. Mm-hmm. And people are talking less. I am very concerned about that.
Interesting. That face-to-face interaction has so many benefits, that some of which are less obvious than others. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the reasons why I'm really glad to be talking to you, because this is probably one of the less obvious advantages to being social and and disadvantages to staring at a screen.
Right. Yeah. That's right. And so there's obvious social advantages to being social, sort of by definition.
Yeah, right. Yeah. It's amazing how that works.
But there's enormous cognitive benefits of talking. And we can see this in, I said there was both talking benefits in the moment and over the lifetime. And we can see the effects of a lot of talking versus a little talking over the lifetime.
Yeah.
And older adults who don't talk much or who stop talking much when they retired or whatever, those people are more at risk for dementia than people who continue to have a rich social and talking environment, because it's training and enriching your brain.
All right. Well, good. You inspired me to spend even more time hanging out with people I love, and I enjoy doing that anyway.
Awesome.
What got you into this? Was young Mary Ellen thinking, you know, I want to study these aspects of language and speech, or how did you come into this?
I always liked language, I think. When I was about five, I think. Yeah. I grew up I was on Staten Island, New York, and then my family, we moved to Southeast Texas near the Louisiana border, and it was very different, and the accents were different, and what counted as being polite was different, and everything was confusing and different. And it got me thinking about why things were the way they were, and every time I thought I knew what was going on, and then I didn't know what was going on in kindergarten or whatever because there was some new word or way to say something, it really got me thinking. And
that's a good way to get into it. When I was probably in junior high ish, I was reading books. There were at least two of them, maybe more than that, by an author named Edwin Newman. Does that? Yeah, yeah, you know who he is. Yeah, Strictly Speaking was one of them, and I loved those books because he had a sense of humor, and he would talk about use of language, you know, both correctly and incorrectly. And one of my favorite lines of his was when he heard a sports announcer say such and such a player has been hit in his one eye, and Newman's reply to that was, he's apparently mistaking this athlete for Cyclops.
Oh, I love that story. It shows you were destined to be an interviewer.
I guess. Yeah, I didn't think of that, but there it is. Is there anything about your book or your research that you would like our listeners to know, but I maybe haven't gotten the right question to get to?
Oh, well, I think maybe we could talk about the sort of emotional benefits of talking a little more. So therapists encourage people to talk in therapy about what they're feeling, because as I said, there's a benefit for naming your emotions and so forth. But not everybody can afford a therapy or find a therapist who needs them. And I want everybody to know that the research about talking to yourself, often by writing a journal, is really good, strong research that shows that you can gain a lot of the benefits from therapy by writing down your ideas about emotionally difficult situations you've encountered and what you're thinking about them and how you're feeling about them. And that's kind of counterintuitive. Let's go unpack some trauma here.
Well, right.
And many people will think that's not a good idea. But the research is really clear that writing, although if you want to record it on your phone, fine. I mean, it doesn't matter. The modality doesn't matter as much as doing it regularly. So I'll just say writing down your thoughts about things, that your boss irritates you, that you love your cat. They can be good things or bad things.
Okay.
And reflecting about how people, items, events in the world are affecting your emotions is a really positive thing that you can do.
Okay.
And I think of writing as a form of all of this talking.
Right.
It has the conversion process and the emotional resonance and all of that.
Yeah, because what a good therapist does, of course, is ask the right questions to get you to express those things.
Mm-hmm.
And if you don't have the benefit of a therapist, you maybe have to ask yourself the right questions, but it's the process of of articulating those thoughts either verbally or in a journal. That is great.
That's
right. I'm hoping that Maggie right now isn't writing down how her boss irritates her. I can't see her in there. Terrific. And then the only other thing I want to ask you is, what do you do for fun? Do you have hobbies? Do you play sports? Do you just get to know a little bit of who you are outside of this heavy research?
Yeah. I don't play sports. I'm pretty klutzy.
Okay, fair
so
enough.
I do love riding my bike when the weather allows in Wisconsin.
Ah, yes.
And I like to go on hikes and walk and all of those sort of kind of, you might call those sports, but, you know, things that klutzy people can do.
Okay, cool.
I love to read. I like to cook. I like to travel. I like to think about new ideas. Like,
yeah.
I mean, I like my own field and I like to study. I read stuff about it, but there are other interesting fields too, and often I like to learn something new.
Yeah, that's a fun thing for me too, is just to dig into a book and learn new things. I was recently in a play about the jazz pianist Thelonious Monk, and I was the narrator for this play, and then someone loaned me a book. It's a tome. It's like 400 and some pages, but it's his biography, and so that's what I'm reading right now. I'm learning. I'm digging in more on the life of Thelonious Monk. Yeah, so there you go.
Excellent.
Yeah. Terrific. Thank you so much. This has been really enlightening. There's a lot to unpack here, and I think we got to a lot of it. So thank you so much.
Thanks so much. I've had such fun.
Good.
You've been listening to the Badger Talks podcast. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Professor Emerit Mary Ellen McDonald, speaking on her book, More Than Words, How Talking Sharpens the Mind and Shapes Our World. Please browse our previous episodes for other topics that may be of interest to you. Badger Talks Podcast is a creation of UW Connects and produced at Audio for the Arts Recording Studio in Madison, Wisconsin. Our music is composed by Bill Purdy and performed by the UW Marching Band. Our engineer is Maggie Shays. I'm Buzz Kemper. Thank you for listening.